This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
This week on the Mike Wise Show, we have the great Stan Van Gundy with us. He's one of the most colorful characters in NBA history, and beyond being a great person, he's a hell of a coach. So let's get to it. Darlene, do your thing.
The Mike Wise Show is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Mike Wise Show is hosted by a guy who played basketball atrociously for Hawaii Pacific College, which forced him into journalism. And, oh yeah, he wrote about basketball for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and ESPN. He's also a wise ass, and so are many of his guests. Right, Mike?
Thank you again, Darlene. This week's guest is one of the most unique members of the basketball family. He's Pelicans head coach, Stan Van Gundy. Stan, where do we begin? I have no idea.
I don't know. We're trying to begin with playing a little bit of defense, Mike, which we haven't been doing any of. So that's where we're beginning. But where you want to begin, I don't know.
Yeah, no, we'll get that out of the way real quick because it is, look, it's the most important thing going on in your life right now professionally. I think I love those young guys. They're just a fun team. But defense is such a bedrock of what you teach, what you preach, and how you win. And it's one thing for guys to be missing shots, but it must eat you up inside when you're just not getting the effort that you want.
Yeah, it's effort and focus, but it's just we haven't been good there. I mean, we're 28th in the league right now defensively, and that's not going to get it done. Our offense is good. We're the seventh best offense in the league. Over the last 11 games, we've been the best offense in the league. So, we've improved on that end of the floor. We were struggling early in the year, and now we're not turning the ball over. We're getting good shots. Our two best players are playing, outstanding basketball and getting other people involved besides just scoring. There's a lot. Alonzo Ball's playing well at the offensive end of the floor and shooting the ball. Bledsoe shot the ball well all year. We're playing well at that end. And if we could just even be decent defensively, we'd give ourselves a chance. But right now we're not there. It's a good group, high character group. I think they want to get it done. We just don't have the habits right now. We don't to be where we need to be.
Zion Williamson, I want to say he's a guy beyond his years because of how much he's progressed. But sometimes, basketball doesn't equate to what a guy's like. It's everything I've heard from you, you sound like you really enjoy coaching him.
Yeah, look, I mean, he's, first of all, as you said, I mean, he's an amazing talent. He hasn't yet played his 50th game in the NBA, and he's 20 years old, doesn't turn 21 until July. I mean, it's amazing what he's able to do offensively and at the efficiency level. He's incredible. The first thing this summer, Coach K was gracious enough to take some time to talk with me because obviously Brandon Ingram, Zion, his guys took a lot of time. And what he kept saying about Zion was how smart he was. He just kept coming back to that. And that has certainly played out. I mean, he's a smart guy in terms of learning whatever it is you want to do system-wise. He's a smart guy in terms of being able to analyze what's happening on the court. So that's fun. His talent is fun. He's just like most of our team. He's got a long ways to go defensively. That's really the issue, So we'll see what happens. We're trying to transition him more and more into being a primary ball handler.
Yeah.
Playing some point forward. I don't know that, we can do that a lot more than we are based on his conditioning and things, you know. And I don't mean that his conditioning is bad. It's just you're taking a big body, and if you're asking him to do that on a full-time basis, it's tough. So we're trying to get him on free throws and dead balls, places like that where he can handle and lead the offense, trying to develop a little bit more of a package around him, that type of thing. I think the sky's the limit with him, you know, starting to really make free throws now, you know, up to around 80% over the last five games. I think eventually he's going to be able to shoot the three and shoot it well. You know, looking at his future, which will go far beyond my tenure here.
You don't know that.
No. I'm 61 years old. My man's 20, you know.
Okay.
I'm not going to be doing this in 15 years. I know that. You know, it's just he's going to be a guy that's going to be fun for all of us to watch over the years as he continues to improve and get better.
I love that interview with Coach K, by the way. I listened to it. It was like live when I heard it and I was driving along. And there was a great point where Coach K brought up the quote that J.J. Redick had about training camp. That was hilarious. Like, I know what to expect from Stan already. And but it was, you know, it was almost in an affectionate way.
Well, yeah. And we, you know, the tough part for me is, Mike, we came out of training camp exactly the opposite of what we are now. We came out of the training camp. We only had 2 weeks, but we came out of training camp defending really well, really hard. We were one of the best defensive teams in the league. We were top 10 defense. We were struggling offensively to sort of fit together our spacing and stuff with Zion and Steven Adams and everything else. But we came out of the gates at 4-2 based mainly on our defense. And I don't know if it's been the lack of practice time, which I'm not using that as an excuse because every team in the league is in the same boat. But I don't know with our guys if it's a lack of practice time, haven't had the chance to build habits, or we've just lost focus. But we've gotten steadily better offensively and steadily worse defensively. So how we turn that around, I'm not really sure. It's something we're working at every day. We'll meet again today and, you know, try to talk to our guys and watch film and try to figure this thing out. Cause I do think they want to get it done. It's a good group.
Yeah. You can see they like each other. In the 90s, you would just get some like tough SOB and get them in for like minimum salary. And he would just start, he would enforce the notion that defense was important to the team and the team would follow along, but you got to be careful these days. And if that's not ingrained in a guy's mentality, it's a hard thing to build, I imagine. I
mean, it is a hard thing to build, that defensive mentality and the defensive habits. And, you know, it goes to, you know, how you evaluate yourself. Are you evaluating yourself only on your offensive numbers, or do you evaluate yourself defensively? What I've seen from our guys is they you know, they hold themselves to a high level of accountability on the offensive end. I mean, you know, they'll get upset with themselves if they're not playing well, that type of thing. But on the defensive end, not so much. I don't think – it's not that they don't care at all. It's not that. I just don't think they judge themselves in that way on the defensive end of the floor. And that's all part of that mentality you're talking about. It's got to change that, you know – that's half the game. You've got to have the same level of accountability that you hold yourself to on that end as you do on the offensive end.
Yeah, you know, progressive is such a, overused term, but I would say enlightened and respectful of others. I like that you guys, and, you know, I always get a hard time about being called part of the woke police, but I thought it was awesome that you guys had no problem bringing in Teresa Weatherspoon on your bench, Swin Cash in the front office, and like your team governor's Gail Benson. I mean, to me, it's just very cool, and it signifies the kind of change that everybody needs in the league.
Well, I think what you're looking for is the best people, and the challenge, quite honestly, is, you know, we hear about the old boys network the whole time. And it's not as, it's real, but it's not as nefarious as I think some people would attribute it to is, I think all of us, when we're assembling staffs, are, you know, we want to put together the best staff we can. And you tend to go to the people that you know best yourself or can get the best information on, right? Yeah. And so, you know, I hired, for instance, Bob Beyer and Rex Walters and Ben Oudry, all guys that I had been with before. So I know them. Okay. And then we keep Fred Vinson and Darnell Lazar, you know, who have been here and people know. And so when you start to get out of that network, it gets hard. Now, I was fortunate in that Teresa was with the Pelicans last year.
Yeah.
And so all I did basically was elevate her on my staff. But I knew, and I think one of the problems with, especially in our league with women getting in and things, is guys like myself don't run in those circles. And so we don't know a lot of the great women coaches out there. I mean, I know who they are and respected and things like that, but my circle there isn't big enough, and you have to get outside of your comfort zone and talk to people and, you know, find the best people. And so that's what I think happens when people talk about the old boy network. I think most people in most jobs, unfortunately, stick to the people they know the most about. And until we can get more women into the pipeline. And by that, I mean, I think one of the problems with what we've done in the NBA, not a problem, but one of the failings of it is we've concentrated so much in terms of getting women on the bench. You know, Becky Hammon was the big story in the whole thing. What we need to do is, I think, have a real focus on getting more women in the video room, getting more women into internships, because that's how these people come up. You know, I mean, Eric Olstra, video room guy.
Video coordinator.
Yeah. Frank Vogel, video room guy. You know, so that's the entry level position in our league. We need to get women into those jobs and give them a chance to grow in organizations. So now people say, hey, that woman's really good. She's really good. Yeah. And they make it on their own, and they make it on their own merits in that way. And then the second thing we need to do is somehow we've got to, people like me have to increase our, it's hard now in this day and age with COVID, but increase our interaction, let's say in the off season, with women coaches at all levels to get to know who's really good and who you like and, you know, who you would be interested in hiring and things like that. We've got to get outside of our own circle. And, because it does become an old boys network, and not because that's intentional, but you've got to intentionally do something different.
I feel white men like ourselves are being marginal. No, I'm kidding. It's that was my Sean Hannity.
Yeah, I know. That's that kind of stuff makes you laugh when you feel like all the advantage, when I see all the advantages that I've personally had and everything else. So, it's easy, quite honestly, in the NBA. You know, I think we've done a good job as a league. You know, I look at Richard Lapchick,
the diversity guy.
Yeah, and he grades all the leagues and things. Yeah. And our league always does fantastic in terms of racial diversity. I'm sure we could be better, but we do well in that area. But gender diversity is a whole nother thing. And so it's just something I think that we've got to get to know people outside of our own sphere to know who's really good. And so, like I talked to Swin when I first got here, you know, when we were putting the staff together, about Spoon and about some other women coaches and things like that, because there's just, I mean, believe me, I know plenty, but a lot of the ones I know are in positions. They're not leaving to become an assistant.
Yeah. You know? Some of them got great college. Some of them got head coaching college jobs.
Exactly. But there's some great women coaching in our league now. And
what's Teresa Witherspoon doing?
She's on our bench.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. She's on our bench, and she last year was they called her a two-way coach. So she was going with their two-way players back and forth from New Orleans to Erie. So,
but I'm sorry, like, what's she doing? Like, I'm sorry, what's she doing on your bench? Like,
so she, in terms of players, she's spending a lot of time with our point guards, and particularly she has put in, she's the primary person working with our rookie, Kyra Lewis, who's played very well of late, and we're given a chance, 19 years old. Wow. She had coached either his cousin or his aunt when she was in college. So she knew him a little bit. Their relationship was good. She pushes him hard. She's been great with him. Yeah. She tends to look at the game from a defensive vantage point. So, you know, a lot of her suggestions and things like that in staff meetings are at the defensive end of the floor. And then, like everybody on our staff, she sort of coaches everything. But I would say her two major things are our defense and our point guards, particularly Kyra Lewis.
And, you know, what's crazy about it, the whole thing is look, I would never say the NBA is nothing but the most progressive league in North America and probably the world. And I love the way Adam Silver thinks about a lot of things. But there is sort of like this. Sometimes the NBA stops itself and says, do we want to be like a movement, or do we want to be a business owners that only, and do we want to pretend this? And I thought that was, you know, that whole mixed messages thing came up pretty well last week about the national anthem, which, you know, I'm going to be honest here. When I saw that, I was like, it's great. What, you know, why do we need this? Like, why do we have to fuse nationalism and sports together? And when Mark Cuban made the decision to do it, nobody knew about it for 10 weeks until The Athletic reported it. And then all of a sudden it became league policy again. You had a great quote. This should happen everywhere. You tweeted, if you think the anthem needs to be played before sporting events, then play it before every movie, concert, sure. And what good reason is it to play the anthem for a game? I was like, he's right. After the World Cup, the Olympics, maybe a high state high school or college final. I don't need to hear it. It'd be more special. Why do we go back and forth and waffle on this? Is it just, it's going to cost us dollars if we piss off the real faux patriots?
Well, yeah, it's just strange to me. I mean, not even getting into the politics of it. It's strange to me, like you say, like, why do we play it? Why the connection between sports and patriotism and not movies and patriotism and not concerts and patriotism? Like the one somebody had tweeted out, I don't know, in the summer or whatever, like, we're at a concert where there's actually people who can play music and they don't play the national anthem. So why are we doing it at a football game? And, you know, when you look at stuff like that, you go, yeah, it just, a lot of it doesn't make sense. You know, and it's become to me a, you know, unfortunately, it's become a very divisive issue, the national anthem. And I think what we have to understand is if we're going to play the national anthem, then we have to understand that not everyone is going to have the same view of our country as everyone else. And we need to allow them to express that. I mean, if we're going to start the game making a political statement, now they'll say it's not, it's just the national anthem. It's a political statement to honor our country. I think we have to, you know, give people the room to not honor our country, because not everyone's had the same experience here as everyone else. And so to me, have the anthem or not, but if you're going to have it, then forcing everyone to respond in the same way to it, to me, doesn't seem fair. And it certainly is not progressive.
Well, plus we're in this red versus blue world now. Like, I live 35 minutes from the steps of the Capitol, and, you know, like, I'm sorry, the flag was used as a weapon to beat a cop. And so I'm thinking to myself, like, what? How, you know, the flag and the anthem now become weaponized, like these new referendums on patriotism. It's like, what does it have to do with how much you love this country? Like Cuban started the Fallen Heroes Fund and has raised tons of money for wounded warriors and vets. He's more patriotic than anybody complaining about him not being patriotic.
Yeah, I mean, it's just stupid. It really is sort of crazy, all of these things. And, you know, the thing that to me is the most disturbing right now, and I don't care which side you're on, I think we'd all have to agree that we're not in any way a united country. I mean, we're at least two different countries, maybe even more. And the thing that concerns me, you know, Joe Biden talks a lot about unity. I don't even know if it's possible right now because I don't see us as having shared values. In fact, we don't even share the same facts, let alone the same values.
That's the scariest thing.
We share the same facts and then just disagree on what the solutions were. Now we don't share the same facts. We're in this post-fact world and we don't share any values. Like, I think people on the other side look at people like me and say, what the hell are you talking about? Like, they don't understand. And I don't understand them. Like, we're not, I don't know what values we share. And so when you don't share values, I don't know how you come together. And that makes me, Mike, very pessimistic.
Yeah.
The thing that gives me optimism is people my players' ages and my kids' ages. My kids are in their 20s. My players, most of them are in their early 20s. You know, those people, I think, look at people different, look at issues like equality different. There are hope because our generation, quite honestly, has screwed everything up. I mean, it's distressing to me what a bad job we've done in terms of, like, I think our parents had a great, you know, one of their great goals was, I think all of our parents' goals was they were going to leave the world a better place for their kids and the next generation, both within their own family, but in broader picture for the next generation. Now, we might disagree on some of the things they believe in, but I think they genuinely had a commitment to that. And I think we've been the me generation. And so if I can make more money, the hell with pollution and what happens to the climate and everything else. If I can keep more money in my pocket, then I don't care if there's people out there that could benefit from, you know, more government assistance and a higher tax rate on
them.
We've become the me generation. And to me, that's all of us. That's not one party as opposed to the other, that we've not lived up to what I would think would be our obligation to our kids in the next generation. And so we've kicked the can down the road and we're going to have to leave it to them to, you know, to do the pooper scooping after us and pick it up and try to make it all better. And luckily, I think they're going to be up to the challenge. I've seen some young people that give me tremendous hope. And I think once they can get us the hell out of the way, maybe we've got a chance.
Yeah, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, you're almost from the Mutual Admiration Society. I'm always seeing stuff you put out there and it makes me think. And one thing I can't stand, it doesn't matter if it's my old buddy, Frank Isola, who's like, you know, what are you, this guy with white guilt? And I'm like, no, I don't have white guilt. I have human contempt for people that don't treat other people like people that look like them. Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me. And so I wonder, we talked about your parents, Bill Van Gundy, your mother, Cindy, who I've talked to in the stands many times, having covered Jeff for many years as a coach and known you and both the family. Did you get your social conscience from them, or is this something that grew and developed as you started working in college in the league and you know, was just sort of it became like almost a learned thing more than an inbred thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. Look, I think I got my integrity. I think I learned a lot of that from my parents for sure. My dad's a very principled guy. My mom's a very principled person. I got that from them, but they're both really, really conservative. We don't agree on much at all politically. When we get to issues of racial justice, we agree on virtually everything. But aside from that, there's not much we're going to agree on.
Jeff's definitely more conservative than you.
A little bit, but not a whole lot.
Yeah, that's true.
Not a whole lot. But I think for me, it's just been an evolution over time. And certainly the more time I spent around people in college and in this league and hearing their stories, people of color, you know, hearing their stories of things that happened. I mean, one of the most profound for me was, you know, working when I first came to the NBA with Bob McAdoo, somebody who I like and respect, you know, at a very, I mean, Bob's one of the best people you could ever meet. And him talking about growing up in segregated schools and how they were treated. And Bob's older than I am, but not by a lot, you know, and how he came up through. And it's just, you look at that and you say, that's not very long ago. This is totally unfair. I mean, he Bob made it out because he could play basketball, but you can just see, you know, all those other kids that grew up with Bob and didn't have his talent, not getting the opportunities and things like that. It's not a fair world. And to me, if we believe in the American ideals and the American dream, we should want it to be available to everybody. And that's the distressing thing to me, is so many people seem to want to have it for themselves, but not make it available. And so, yeah, for me, it's been more hearing all the stories, you know, like I say all the time, I haven't met a Black person, an adult, somebody my age or close, anybody who gets kids that become teenagers, especially boys, that haven't had to sit them down and have a talk about what you do when a police officer pulls you over when you're driving, so that you come home safely. And that just, when I first started hearing it, I thought it was sort of isolated and maybe alarmist. And then it's everybody. And you just say, like, that's got to piss you off. That, like, I have four kids and one of them's a son and he's 26. I've never had that conversation.
Yeah.
He gets pulled over. Number one, he probably deserved it. And number two, he's going to get a ticket and he's going to be retreated okay. And he's going to come home. I'm not telling him to keep both hands on the steering wheel and ask for permission to open the glove box. I'm not doing any of that.
Yeah.
I don't have to do any of that. And the fact that other people do, and, you know, I've had any number of players and assistant coaches who get pulled over driving in their own neighborhoods at home because obviously they have some money and they're in a nice neighborhood and they're driving a nice car, and some police officer doesn't think they belong there because they have the wrong color skin. Like, you know, I'll have people say to me, well, what's the big deal? He pulled him over. He didn't do anything. Once he knew he left there, he let him go. I said, it's humiliating. What somebody's telling you, even when they let you go, what they're telling you, because you weren't doing anything wrong. You weren't speeding. You weren't doing anything. What they're telling you is you don't belong here. And that has to seep into your psyche at some point. And I don't know how people can just brush that off as no big deal. You know, it just, those are the stories that have sort of brought me along initially. And then you get into all these things happening you know, you read statistics and what's going on, and we're a very unequal country. And look, we always have been. And that's what I think, where you sort of lose people and you piss them off, is when you say we're a racist country and we always have been. Oh my God, people go through the roof. But the facts are there.
Right. I mean, right. Nobody wants to hear that, because then their hackles get up and they play mental gymnastics in their own mind. Like, if he's calling, if he's saying that, that means that I'm, or my parents were, and I can't let myself believe that, because then it means I'm a bad person. And I can't believe it. Like, it's like, you're not a bad person. We just move forward. You know, we get better.
And it's, you know, we have to deal with these things. And as you said, have some empathy for what's going on and try to make some corrections. I mean, we have a huge wealth gap in this country between, you know, black people, white people, and wealth, you know, income is income, but wealth is generational. You know, it builds from generation to generation over families. And so because of slavery and Jim Crow and things like that, black people are way behind. And if we don't do something, nothing will ever change. They can't catch up. Yeah, they can start to grow some wealth, but I'm generations ahead of them.
Yeah.
Generations ahead of them. They will never catch up. And how people can think that that's fair, I don't know. Yeah. And so, you know, you really want to raise the hackles of conservatives, start talking about reparations and things. But I don't know what the alternative to equality is if you don't have reparations.
Yeah, I'm the same way. It's a crazy talk. The idea that something could be coming out of my paycheck based on the color of my skin is frightening. But I'm also like, irrespective of my the color of my skin, there's still stuff coming out for other things. Like, at some point, it makes sense. I don't know how or why, and it'll probably won't come before we get rid of everybody that voted for Donald Trump. But it's just I'm with you in so many ways. I wanted to switch really quick because I know we don't have all the time in the world. You mentioned Frank Vogel and God darn it, Eric Spoelstra earlier, and I thought to myself, you know, what's too about those guys is. One, they obviously paid their dues on the way up, but they never played the game. They never played the game at that level. And I always hated, especially when Jeff would how's Jeff going to, you know, lord over a locker room with Patrick Ewing? And sure enough, the players respected him, like, irrespective of the fact that he never had an NBA career. I hate the labels, but one, I feel like that's your story in a way. Like, that's your story. You played in college, right?
I played small college, not well.
Right, well.
Not well.
So same here. I got scored on by Scott Brooks, scored 35 on my team once. I never got off the bench at American River Junior College, sadly enough. But you like have captured, like, you worked with Dwayne Wade. You developed that guy at an early age. And I think to myself, I'm sure you have a great relationship with him now. Like, what was Dwayne Wade like that area? And obviously he saw something in you that he knew you knew more about the game than him and you could bring it out in it.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but I really don't know.
I'm reaching.
What I did for Dwayne Wade was basically put him out there and give him the ball. That's what I did. Eric Spoelstra was an assistant at the time, did a great job developing it. Him. I don't think I had a lot to do with that at all, but I do think, you know, it's like a lot of things. I think coaches can come from a variety of different backgrounds. And I think guys who played the game have certain advantages. And I think those of us who weren't good enough to play the game and started focusing on coaching maybe earlier have certain advantages. I mean, I just don't think there's one mold into, you know, you've got to do this, 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 and this to get there. I think that, you know, there's some great stories of people who have worked their way up in the video room. And then there's, you know, guys like Steve Nash who finish a playing career and go straight to being a head coach. I mean, look, Pat Riley didn't spend much time as an assistant coach, and he played the game. So I just, there's a lot of different backgrounds and there's not one. And you know, it's, Yeah, I think we all sort of lean to the guys who have more of the background I do, but you know, that's who you sort of gravitate to and root for and the whole thing. But I've seen great coaches with all kinds of different routes to get there. So
was there I don't
think there's any one way.
I cut you off, but was there a fork in the road in your career where somebody reached out and said, look, you know, obviously you work for Pat Riley maybe, but was there a fork in the road where that, you know, that you can point to and say, I could have went this way, I could have went this way, and this happened?
I've just been really, really lucky. I'm, you know, and the luckiest thing is, you know, I got fired at the University of Wisconsin in 1995. And the timing of my firing proved to be fortuitous because, you know, I was looking for college jobs after that, even applying for jobs, Mike, at like the Division II level coming from Wisconsin. And I was just stuck. I got a couple of interviews, but I wasn't getting anywhere. And then Pat left the Knicks, you know, sort of middle of the night. And my brother had another year on his contract. And so Pat wanted to bring him.
That's right.
But the Knicks wouldn't let him. And so Pat was looking for people. And my brother said, oh, you should talk to my brother, which got me the fact that Jeff had done a good job for Pat got me an opportunity to interview. And I ended up lucky enough to, you know, to get on his staff in Miami. And so, you know, if I had been fired a year later at Wisconsin, if they had given me another year, I don't have any idea where I'd be. You know, I mean, it's just, that's the thing. I mean, people, I think we all want to believe that we're where we are because of our great merit and everything else. And so much of it is, yeah. And I'm not trying to be overly modest. When you get your opportunity, you have to be good at it.
Yeah.
So much of getting the opportunity is just luck. And I've coached at the Division III, Division II, Division I levels in college, and now the NBA. And at every level, I can point to guys who are just as good as the people that I'm coaching against in the NBA, but they just haven't had the same opportunities.
Yeah, so I
don't know why people want to discount that or feel it makes them less than. It's the same thing when we're talking social stuff. To say there's white privilege, I'm not discounting someone's hard work and what they've done and everything else. I'm just saying you weren't held back by the color of your skin. That's right. All I'm saying. But that really upsets people. And it's the same thing if you say to anyone, wow, you were really lucky to get where you are. I mean, Jeff and I's story, and I mean, I sort of have ridden Jeff's coattails to the NBA, but it all started with him having a really good high school sophomore, his 1 year as a high school coach. And Stu Jackson comes in, sees him work the kid out, recommends that Rick Pitino hire him.
All right, he was in Rochester. That's right.
Yeah, it starts Jeff's whole path to eventually coming into the NBA with Stu Jackson. And then he goes through this whole cycle and then brings me into the NBA. If it wasn't for Greg Woodard at McQuaid Jesuit High School in Rochester, I mean, who knows where we are? I'm a small college coach, and I don't know where Jeff is. So there's a lot of luck involved in this, you know?
Yeah, but once you guys got your chances, I look at, I'm completely with you. The game in which just tore your heart out at the time. I remember walking into the locker room after it happened and I was covering the Knicks and Allen Houston hits that crazy shot in game 5 in 99 and it rolls in. And I remember, talking to Jeff about it years later, because Checkets was, you know, there was no clear thing that Jeff was coming back and all this thing was happening. And Checkets literally went to lunch with him that week. And I can tell the story now. Oh, what do you think is going to happen to Jeff? And he's like, yeah, after they lose this series, he's probably going to, you know, become a, you know, maybe he'll get a Division II head job. He could be a Division I assistant. He could be an NBA assistant again. And I'm like, you don't see him as a head coach? And he goes, come on, Jeff Van Gundy. I mean, this is like 2 weeks before, you know, he's going into the playoffs. And so I'm looking at this now and I'm going, and Jeff said it right. And he goes, you know, if that shot went in or not, I'm not a good, better coach or worse coach. It just happened. And I got a contract extension and we went to the finals that year. And so, you know, and I remember you coming in and you were just like torn apart. And I don't know. What's your relationship with Riley now? Like, where are you with Pat Riley?
I don't really have one. I mean, I have great appreciation for the opportunity that he gave me. And I have, great appreciation for everything that I learned from him, which was substantial. So, there's no, and I hope there's not on his part. I mean, there's no, animosity or anything. I just haven't maintained a relationship with him.
And was that after the firing in Miami since then?
Well, I didn't get fired in Miami. People don't want to believe that, but I truly did step away.
You resigned.
I wasn't happy.
Well, Shaq was being a pain in the ass.
Shaq was not being a problem. I mean,
he wasn't okay.
No, Shaq was not being a problem. Shaq was actually hurt to begin that year. He came back, played one game before I resigned, but I'd already worked out the deal with Pat and Mickey to resign. No, Shaq was great with me.
And Orlando had to give Miami draft picks to hire
you. Yeah, a couple years later, that got a little crazy, but no, I walked away on the Miami thing on my own. Not any regrets that I did that. I was really, really unhappy at the time. There were just things going on I didn't like and got away from it, and then had a great experience in Orlando. And, it's all been good, but I have great appreciation.
Yep. Jeff told me
without Pat.
Yeah. Jeff, you don't have to go further on this, but Jeff told me something once and I remember it well. He goes, the guy taught me so much and I owe my NBA start to him. During some of those playoff series and, after the stuff with my brother, he goes, I saw a different side of him and, I'll never disrespect him as a basketball coach and what he's done, because I just saw a different side. He was a different person than I thought. And look, I can see that. I don't think that there's anything that would tell me otherwise.
Look, I mean, I don't dislike the guy. I just haven't maintained a relationship.
Okay.
Like, I've maintained a relationship with Eric and, with Bob McAdoo and Keith Askins and guys I worked with there, Miami Heat did a lot for me. And Pat was a huge part of that. So you appreciate people like that in your life. And we all have, if we're honest, we all have a lot of people like that in our life, people that did a lot for us, that we had great relationships with, that furthered our lives, and life goes on. I mean, I left there in 2005. And so it's been a long time. I mean, a lot of us, lose contact with people that we haven't worked with in 15, 16 years. That's a rare group of people that you maintain contact with for that long. So, I don't see anything that's strange about the fact that we haven't maintained a relationship.
All right, I got two minutes left. It's a lightning round. I want to get you out of here. All-Star game, should it be played? I'm thinking if enough players don't want to do it, it just seems like a luxury in still COVID America that we don't need to take advantage of. I know that they need the money, but I don't think we need to play it. But that's just me.
Yeah, but the whole season has been about money. That's why we're playing. I mean, we're playing it for everybody. So I don't know whether we should or not, but you could make the same case for the season in general that we shouldn't be playing it. But it's a money grab. That's what it is. And we're all, like me too, players, everybody, the league, we want our money. So why would the All-Star game be any different?
That's fair. Last one. Will this Pelicans team make the playoffs under Stan Van Gundy this season?
Well, we certainly hope so. And I think that it will all be, as we will say to our guys again today, Mike, it will all be determined on where we can get to defensively. We have to improve on that end. And I'm not laying all of that on them. As I told them, it's a group thing. We've got to do a better job teaching game plan, system, whatever. And they've got to put more into it in terms of focus and effort. If we can get to the top half of the league defensively, then we've got a shot at the playoffs, even in a loaded Western Conference. If we can't, then we probably don't.
I think your guys are like, you're right. They're at that fork in the road. They can be really special as a young team and with some nice vets, or they can go the other way. And I'm like, I want to go down there right now. I want to run like the thing from Miracle where the guy, you know, Herb Brooks goes again, and just keeps running their asses until they get it.
Well, and Mike, that's a great point, because that's how I think actually that you build the defense, is it's repetition every day in practice. And I think we came out of training camp with that basis. And because of the number of games and my newfound softness and compassion for keeping everybody fresh, we just haven't had the time to drill and repeat and repeat, yeah, and repeat and repeat. And, you know, we have lost whatever it is that we had coming out of training camp, and we've got to, you know, we've got to try to slowly get it back. Again, I'm counting on the character of our guys and their commitment and everything else to start making strides in that area, but it's going to have to be a nightly focus, possession by possession.
Yeah, and I know the work's going to help. Thank you so much for being part of this. I just want to say you've put yourself on the road to wonderful things. Jeannie Buss did this podcast, and the Lakers won a title. I think Roger Mason Jr. got his own business. I don't want to say that I'm a good luck charm, but okay. I am, and it's true.
That's good. I'll take it.
That was dope.
Thanks to my guest, Pelicans head coach Stan Van Gundy, and also thanks to my producer, Bruce Bernstein. Kristen Woolley is our editor now. Thanks, Kristen. Welcome aboard. Please check out all of our Pure Hoops media shows. Full Court with Jenny Fisher and Kara Kay has the best in college hoop each Tuesday. Catch and Shoot 2.0 with Otto Strong and Aaron Berlin is here every Wednesday. Last week, they had a great visit with former North Carolina coach Matt Doherty. Buckets, Boards, and Blocks with my friend Monica McNutt and King McClure drops on Thursday. And BJ Armstrong and Eric Newman have the Pure Hoops podcast each Friday. And of course, I've got a new Mike Wise show every Monday. We also have a bunch of great segments you can check out on the Pure Hoops Media YouTube channel.
All right, let's go. Time to stick the landing.
We've had so many stupid bonus tracks from 2020 already this year, but I hope 2021 is when we snuff this pandemic out as soon as possible. When you qualify for the vaccination, please do the right thing. But until that day arrives, keep your guard up. Wear the mask in public to protect yourselves and others. Hell, listen to Dr. Fauci. Wear two masks. Wash your hands. Keep your distance. Be considerate of others. And keep all the medical professionals in your prayers. They're still our heroes. Till next time, peace.
The Mike Wise Show used to be called the Wise Ass Show, but it remains a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.